Hello, this is Peter Jacoby. In determining to focus a profiles program on the distinguished pianist and pedagogue Menahem Pressler, those of us who planned the interview determined that there's just too much to cover for a single show. Our decision was to spread the life, career, and wisdoms of Professor Pressler across 2 hours, 2 programs, devoting session one, this one, to Pressler, the soloist and teacher, and our follow-up to Pressler as the ever-present element of the Beaux-Arts Trio, thereby celebrating 50 years of that ensemble's remarkable existence on the world's concert scene. I want to thank you, Menahem, for joining me. You know, it seems highly appropriate that we're taping these programs for Profiles at a time when you're in Texas, once again judging a Clyburn competition. You as pianist, you as an often called upon judge for competitions, you as a teacher of young keyboard talent, you must have a jumble of emotions as you listen and analyze the contestants, knowing the pressures that they feel.
Indeed, I do. Let me first say what a pleasure it is, Peter, to have the interview with you, who has been my friend for many, many years that I met IU. Indiana University School of Music. But I must say, yes, this Texas competition is something very wonderful, exciting, and illuminating, and one learns as much as one is asked to give of themselves to judge, and as I do also here, I teach at the Clyburn Institute master classes. But what it is that you do see in front of your eyes, not just with your student, that there is a change in times, that people used to do this and do now that, and used to play that repertoire and do now this repertoire. So there is a change in taste, there's a change in approach, and what is amazing, there is an enormous rise in the ability to handle the keyboard. Today's young people can play the most difficult pieces that used to be only given to a very few that could play it, the possibility to do it. But now many, many of these young people do play these pieces. There is a but, and that's the great but, I think, that we always should be aware of and should be recognizing, that art is not a craft. So what I'm speaking of is actually the craft of playing the instrument, the craft of being at home at the most difficult pieces. But to be at home playing the piece, or to be at home in the thought of the great composers who have left over the message that we should continue giving, that actually made these pieces alive today as they were 100, 200 years ago, that is not given to many. And so it is our duty and pleasure to find the right person that should win this prize to continue the heritage of the great pianists and the great musicians.
You must have an idea of what is going on in their minds, because you've gone through this. I mean, early in your career.
Of course I do. In most cases, what goes through their minds is as if their life depends on it, as if that's it, and there is no tomorrow unless I come through and win. And, of course, that is the wrong thing, but that is probably what goes through their mind. When I went to the first competition, the reason was different. The reason was I came from Israel. The country was closed to anyone. It was just opening up. And I went to a competition to San Francisco, not to win. That was not even in my thought. I went to find out, how do I stack up among young pianists of today? So when I went to San Francisco, it was for different reasons. When I won, of course, the elation, I would imagine, is the same at any time, at any place, at any competition.
Now, you once told me, and I quote you, life is a fulfillment. Nature injected in me the genes to love good music, to make it and teach it. I'm grateful for every moment. Could you tell us where that love for music began and when and who gave you that push?
It's very hard to say that because the love, I saw it around me. My parents loved to listen to a record. But the love is something that it is in you. And the size of the love, the hunger and the desire to make music is in you. And no one actually, in reality, can give it to you. Maybe it was given in the genes that you don't see. But actually and truly, that is something I always remember, that enormous hunger of wanting to make music and wanting to listen to music. I remember even sometimes I would come back home after teaching 6-7 hours, and surely the ears ought to be tired. Mm-hmm. And I would open the radio to hear some more music. It is some kind of a compulsion with which I was born and which I am glad exists to this very day.
And you do have memories of teachers both in your native Germany and then in Israel? Did you study in both places?
Oh, of course I did. Yeah. I studied in many places. But I do remember in Germany a very, very kind man who, as my piano teacher, he was an organist in a church, and especially during these very difficult times of Hitler Germany, he was very kind to me and was helpful to me, and I could go to his home and take a lesson, and it was truly a most wonderful memory that I have of him. And then, of course, coming to Israel, at the time it was Palestine, these teachers that I had, remarkable people that would have been probably not there if not for these circumstances, a man like Udyakov, he came from Russia, but his education was in Germany and in France, and then Leo Kestenberg, who was a student of Busoni's and came to Palestine to be the director of the Palestine Orchestra, the orchestra that Huberman founded, that is today the Israel Philharmonic, and he was a wonderful spirit. And so I was with very fine teachers, and at the same time also with very fine peers, with very fine young pianists, with very fine young musicians who, like me, aimed for something that is beautiful, and were working as hard as we could. And the only examples, or most of the examples that we had, besides what was inside the country, were those records that we had of the great masters. And they were, of course, of tremendous inspiration and value, and a matter of feeling, where do you want to go? That's the example.
Well, you mentioned the San Francisco experience, which certainly must be considered a key moment, I guess, in the development of your career. Are there other times when that career of yours seemed to leap forward?
After San Francisco, I was brought to New York, and I played for one of the great managers in America, the head of Columbia Artists, Mr. Arthur Judson, and he signed me to a contract, and at the same time he arranged for auditions, and I auditioned for Eugene Ormandy, who engaged me to play with the Philadelphia Orchestra, to make my debut with the Philadelphia Orchestra.
You're starting at the top, my dear. Arthur Judson and the Philadelphia Orchestra, my goodness.
And Ormandy, yes, you're laughing, but it was at the top. It was something unbelievable, right out of a storybook. And the storybook went further, that during this first or second year, I played with Stokowski and the New York Philharmonic and Sal and the Cleveland Orchestra. I mean, it really something that you dream about. And so I lived my dream at that time, which was wonderful. But at the same time, I felt that there's still a lot to be learned. I went to some great masters, Egon Petri, who was a friend of Gerstenberg's and a fellow student of Busoni's. I went to Robert Casadesus, who then later in life played a big role in my life, besides that being a teacher there. And last but not least, the man that I thought was one of the greatest musicians I ever met, that is Mr. Steuermann in New York, who was truly an unbelievable musician. By the way, the pianist for whom Webern wrote his variation and Schoenberg dedicated his piano concerto to. But he was equally at home in Beethoven and Schumann and Brahms.
Tell us a little bit more about him, because he isn't that well known today.
No, he came to America being the pianist of the Vienna School. And, of course, not being well known, as you say, did have quite a hard time. So he started teaching in the settlement school in Philadelphia until he came to Juilliard. He had students, of course, who were immediately great devotees to him because his knowledge and his passion was tremendous. He had one, I would call it weakness, and some would call it strength. When the student was weak, he was enormously complimentary. When the student was good, he was critical. The student was very good, he was very critical. And the wonderful part that I realize now, that one comes to him at the right time, that he could take a position on this side of the fence or on that side of the fence, a true Talmudist in music, which, in other words, freed you, because there is not one preconceived idea. There are many ideas. And by knowing that there are many ways to Rome, there are many ways to heaven, he really made it possible for you to deeper search to something where you are just, where you do justice to the written score. At the same time, your taste developing so that you inject that part of a personality of yours which makes an interpretation personal.
Well, I gather you've taken on some of those aspects as a teacher yourself from what I hear. But
I don't try to be so critical as he was, but I do feel that for a student to learn, one has to have to hold a mirror to the student. Of course, it depends always on the student. It depends on the psychology of the student. And it depends on where you as a teacher feel the need mostly lies with the student. All want to be feeling secure. All want to have the feeling that you are on their side. And I truly try to be on the side of my student. And I do feel that doesn't matter where you start. If you do get better than from the place that you were, that is when a teacher truly is a good teacher. Yes, I am critical, and the better they play, the more my critique aims for them to fulfill the maximum or close to the maximum that their talent will let them. Because the world outside, the matter of competition or the matter of being musically alive demands always a re-evaluation, demands that you cannot say, oh, I played that piece so well last night. Why should I practice today? Why should I not feel I've got it? There is no such a thing. It's like always you're at the bottom of the mountain. You've got to climb, and that climb is each time difficult, sometimes impossible, sometimes a little easier. But the climb in itself, it is truly always the same.
Well, you climb very often as a recitalist, as a guest of chamber ensembles, as a soloist with orchestras. Of all these activities, do you have a favorite?
Life led me to become a chamber musician who spent most of his time doing that. And so by having done it so much, doing it lovingly, doing it with really all my heart and my soul, then I would say I consider myself that. I have loved playing the recitals. It was wonderful and is wonderful. I'm playing now many recitals at this point in my life. I play this point in my life many concerti, and especially Mozart concerti, which are chamber music in the most wonderful way. So, and playing with a string quartet is enhancement of a trio. Then I have two more members out there. But in any case, I would not want to say I would like to miss one of those aspects. No, I wouldn't want to miss, if I can. And if I can still do it, I would always want to play that concerto. And I would want to go through the work, through the love that it takes to play a solo repertoire, which is, of course, for the piano, unending riches. And then when I come home to my trio, I love to dig deeper into that which has been written for that repertoire.
Well, let's listen to you play. We have a recording of you doing the Chopin concerto with the Vienna State Opera Orchestra under Hans Swarovski. I think you chose the slow movement. Is there something you want to say about it?
No, the slow movement has meant a lot to me. When I heard it the first time, I felt, oh, that's how beautiful that is, and always felt I would like to play it. And in the slow movement, there's that which is a recitativo, and I enjoy it, and I love that. And when you have the right orchestra and the right conductor, then, of course, it's very special.
Let's listen to that now, the slow movement from Chopin's F minor concerto. Menachem Pressler, the Vienna State Opera Orchestra, Hans Swarovski conducting. We have just heard the slow movement of the Chopin F minor concerto. Menachem Pressler, our guest in the studio today, was the soloist, and that cantabile playing of yours was ever so much present there. Menachem, I'd always love to hear you. Talk a bit about musical and mental preparation for a concert. I mean, how do you get ready? What's a concert day like, and how difficult is it to give your all and your best every time? You talked about that climbing of the mountain, but expand on that a little bit.
I can extend to that extent that I have experienced all ways of giving a concert, of being rested, well-prepared, and played a decent concert, of being hurried and arriving at the last minute and playing a very good concert. And completely unexpected things do happen during a concert, because the one thing which you cannot order is inspiration. You can call it by any different name. I don't know if there is a different name. But inspiration is that untouchable thing which elevates your playing and brings it into the realm that one can feel as if you compose it, as if it is part of you, which it should be. So when you say preparation for a concert, it is so different, because now in this time of the airplane, it depends when you arrive in a town. It depends on what the hotel is like or how you slept that night. I mean, all that which is supposedly the ideal in the Book of Flesh, in which he writes, you should prepare yourself on the day of a concert, you should get up and have your breakfast, then you go and practice somewhat, and then you walk and have some deep thoughts, and then you come back, you sleep a little bit, you practice a little more, and then you play. But I have sometimes arrived at a concert, like in Strasbourg, with a suitcase at 10 minutes to 8. The concert was at 8, and we barely could get backstage and get our clothes on, and then play well.
You don't even have time to get nervous.
Yeah. No, I tell you, that goes with the territory. Uh-huh. If time or no time, you've got it. And everyone who denies that he is nervous is not telling completely the truth.
Well, I think if you're not nervous, you're really not doing your best work, are you?
Yeah, you don't expect to do your best. Or you are not afraid if you don't do your best. To be nervous means you know yourself from your best side and you know yourself from your worst side. And what you want to do is to be at your best. So you are nervous. But when you arrive at this moment, of course, you're concerned, do I have my music? Is everything all right? And then you walk out. And then, in that short second in which you open the music, after you have taken your bow and you sit down, that moment of concentration in which everything is focused, when that is there, then you are prepared because you have been preparing all your life for that moment. You're not prepared for this concert specifically, although that sometimes happens too when you play a new piece for a specific moment and you learned it for that day. But generally speaking, a concert is that what you are, what you have been doing all your life, and today that's what you are. And hopefully it's something which is that one would like to listen to and gain that pleasure which your insight into the work has given you and that you're capable of giving the message that the composer has asked you to give.
You asked me not to use dates, but I'm going to use one, and that's 1955. And that was the year when the Beaux-Arts Trio was born, an event we'll explore during our next conversation. But it was also significant in another way. You became a teacher.
Exactly.
Assuming a position.
Exactly. It was at the same time that the Beaux-Arts Trio was born. And I guess the Beaux-Arts Trio was born just before I joined Indiana University. Yes, it was something very special in my life. In hindsight, I see, because everything started as a matter of chance. At the time, used to make many records for MGM, and one day I wanted to do Mozart Trio, so they said, get yourself a group together and play. And at the same time, I had been playing some things with a wonderful American pianist called William Marcellus, who had joined Indiana University that year. And he wasn't sure that his stars were aligned, that he should go. And I felt that his circumstances in life would require for him to go. So I said, go. And he said, you wouldn't go, Menachem. And in order to encourage him, I said, of course I would. And he went. And when the school needed another teacher, he and Sidney Forster went in to Dean Bain at the time and said, we suggest that you invite Menachem Pressler. And he looked in his black book and he saw that he had once asked Steuermann to join the faculty, and Steuermann had said he wouldn't come to Indiana, he wouldn't go to a small town. He's a man who needs the exhausts of cars in order to live. But he would suggest a young friend, he said, or colleague, or whatever he called me. And so he gave him my name. So my name was in the little black book. and the two of them mentioned it. And he called me. And when he called me, I said, of course, I can't accept because my trio it's just started and immediately became so enormously busy. And he called a second time. And then the two of them called me. And I came for one semester. And that was 50 years ago.
So half a century seems to be very important for you as a performer and as a teacher. Did you at an earlier time plan to teach at all, or was this simply happenstance then?
I think it was simply happenstance. I did have one student, strangely enough, was a girl coming from Texas. And I prepared her for entering the Curtis Institute, which she did. But I didn't think of teaching, and certainly not in that enormous amount of students that we have to teach and which I was teaching and must say, loved teaching. I've always felt that teaching is, in a way, the more relevant and the more important aspect of a musician. Because you want to give something of yourself, to which you do to music. You want to be feeling that you, what you are giving, is important to your listeners. And sometimes you do succeed, and that way you are building an audience for yourself. But when you have a student with whom you share that what you had acquired, with whom you share your insight into things, and insight into that person to help him or her become what they would like to become, a musician, then you feel not only the pleasure of having done when you play a good performance, but the pleasure of having enriched and opened a young mind. And I think we all, in a way, want to be parents. We get married and we want to have children. And here in this case are children of your mind. And that, I think, is something very beautiful. And I've always felt a great satisfaction and pleasure in teaching.
You said to me once that, in a way, teaching is what we have in a marriage with children. The children bring you immortality. So it is with my students. I give them, like a parent, the best I have found in the world of music. They open their hearts, their souls. That's beautiful. And
I'm glad I said that. And I'm even happier that you remembered it.
Well, I used it in a column, and so I looked it up. Because I knew you had told me something about teaching that really sort of stuck, and I wanted to get the words right, and there they are. They're just beautiful. It must be a strain to concertize and to teach, juggle calendar, juggle energy, so that neither is shortchanged. Do you have any tips for people, or do you just do this naturally?
First of all, you do have to be born with a great deal of energy. Energy that plays an enormous role. And when you feel that the changeover from one to the other is really refreshing you. I mean, I come from a tour and I'm looking forward to teach. That is, it's not completely normal. Most people would want to come and rest. And I feel simply filled with energy, having a new boost by having the change of activity. No, it is something that you must want. It is something that you don't do because it's a profession. You don't do for any other reason at that point. You play the concerts because that's what you are, and you teach, is that what you love? And so it is beautiful to be able to combine the two. It is one thing about a teacher in those four walls. When you say, do it this way, and having not experienced yourself that when you don't do it that way, you may fail. So when you can teach from the point of view where you know how to apply that which you have learned so that someone else will avoid mistakes that you have done and therefore will be able to progress even faster than you have, that is the joy of a teacher.
Let's turn to music again, and this time have you perform with another teacher, someone who also has had sort of a double life, and this is Janos Starker, the great cellist, who has been your colleague at Indiana University all these years. And in a very early concert together, you two played the Brahms E minor sonata. First movement, I think, is what you would like to share with us.
Exceptionally beautiful movement. Not that the rest is not beautiful, but that first movement is truly very wonderful. And I remember having the experience with Janos that I have always loved and admired. And we have been friends for over 50 years because I met him the first time when he had just arrived in America. He came to the Dallas Symphony. He was the first cellist with Dorati, and I was a young soloist going down, playing the Schumann Concerto. And we have been friends and from that on and have played many, many times in many places.
Let's hear that friendship in music. First movement from Brahms' E minor cello sonata, Janos Starker and Menachem Pressler. We have just heard the first movement of the Brahms E minor cello sonata with two legends from Indiana University, Menachem Pressler and Janos Starker. Menachem, remaining in one place to teach, not counting, of course, the numerous master classes you give all over the planet all the time, but staying at Indiana University, away from the big world centers and their conservatories, that decision must have come for reasons. And has it been a good decision?
It has been the most wonderful decision of my life. Indiana University happens to be a very, very special place. It created and established a music school to be proud of. I don't think there is a nicer and a better and a more beautiful one anywhere. It had collected a number of extremely wonderful artists in every field, if it was the violin, the cello, the voice, the bass, the horn, you name it, we have it. And all in all, in order to do that and to do a happy musical life as a teacher and as a performer, it needed an administration that was conducive to it. And Indiana has been the school of music especially. Very, very successful in that regards. It had a wonderful, adventurous dean to start with, Dean Bain. It had a marvelous dean coming after him who knew how to keep everyone happy, Dean Webb. And now it certainly, Gwynne Richards, it follows not only in this tradition, adds this new tradition of openness, friendliness, and, I mean, you cannot have a better place to be. So for me personally, being at home in many centers of the musical centers of the world, coming home to Bloomington is not only when I'm home with my family, but when I come home to be in the school, it is truly, like someone said, an island in this world. It's an island of beauty, it's an island of hard work, it's an island of advance in music, and it's just beautiful, and I'm thrilled and happy to be a member of this community and of this faculty. Yes, I am.
Now, with pride, you must look upon your students. Do you try to follow all of them as they go through their life, or do you stay in touch? Do they stay in touch? And for what reasons do some of them give you perhaps a particular satisfaction?
The students give me an enormous satisfaction, not only when they openly succeed by winning an international competition, which some of them did, or being engaged in some of the big schools, universities in the world. It gives me great pleasure. But the one who teaches in a small town and teaches with love and has a class that love music because of their teacher, they give me as much pleasure and as much pride in what I have done to imbue them with that and give them that which makes music relevant, not just in the big places, not just in the so-called glamorous places, but anywhere where music can be performed, can be studied, and can be listened to. Now, students have kept in touch. Now that I have my computer and can type with one finger, I think I can keep faster in touch because I can answer many of their letters much faster and sooner. But as life sometimes is, the ones that you absolutely expect would keep in touch, no, they are far away, but yes, many, many of them do keep in touch, and I really feel they are like my family, children.
Take me to your studio. What is it like to take a class with Menahem Pressler? What happens?
In principle, it should happen close to that a student comes in prepared to play his or her piece. I will sit and listen what they have done and how they have done it. Then I will work with them through the piece from beginning to the end, the way I see it, or I see they must change in order to do that. It's not always that I want them to play as I would or as I see it exactly, but I would like to give them some of the choices. Very often what they do is by just playing the piece, that's the choice they have. Not knowing that an interpretation is not just that you read it and are capable of playing. It is, of course, how you play and what is the style of this composer and what is the moment in the piece that is the great moment of the piece. And so I try to teach that. I hope I always have patience. I'm not sure that I have, but sometimes one is not prepared for certain things. But I always feel that that which is important is that both of us, the student and myself, will work on unison, united, to make him or her better. That, I think, is the goal. And so sometimes it is rougher than other times. But I have realized, and one should realize, that lesson to study, to learn, is not a pleasure in that sense that it is you walk out of a lesson and you walk on cloud nine. When you come out of a lesson, you should know how to get better, which means actually to realize what you don't do so well. Some of the things you know yourself, but many things you don't know yourself, you find out. So a good lesson is that you find out and you find how to get better and what to do. We all had to go through that. And as I told you, I had some lessons which were very difficult with a man like Steuermann. And I actually, all the teachers that I remember, when their demands were such that I all of a sudden felt, oh, I hadn't even realized that that is what I have to do. And that, I would presume, is the same with my students.
Let's hear one more musical selection. because I know our listeners would like to hear you play. And that's a performance at the university with the IU Philharmonic, the Beethoven Choral Fantasy. Do you remember that particular occasion?
I do. I do remember that particular occasion. And for some strange reasons that this life has, the Choral Fantasy has been always with me. I've always loved the piece. And actually, when Banz Mazur, just before we recorded it, said to me, Menachem, do you like the piece? Oh, I said, yes, when that great moment in there with the timpani comes, you can go right through the roof of the room. Oh, he says, no, if you do it right, you go right to heaven. No, I'm still looking for it.
Well, let's hear the opening cadenza from Beethoven's Choral Fantasy, you with the Indiana University Philharmonic. We have just heard the opening section of the Beethoven Choral Fantasy as performed by the IU Philharmonic and Menachem Pressler. Mr. Pressler has been our guest in the studio today. Looking back, Menachem, are there special memories, special lessons that invigorate you, that help keep you so ebullient, or is it just the presence of music itself?
I would say it's the presence of music, but it's also the character of the person with whom you share the music. I mean, with a student who is open and willing to learn, which most of them, or actually all are, willing to learn and capable of learning and assembling fast these things, and in front of your eyes you see the becoming of a real musician and you being part of the father doing it. No, I think it is a very, very invigorating and satisfying moment in your life. And so you feel full of energy and joy, and you come into the lessons like just like that.
Our guest this hour has been the preeminent pianist and teacher, Menachem Pressler. I want to thank him for joining us. Menachem, it's been a pleasure, as it always is, to speak with you. We're going to continue our conversation for another hour, that one devoted to your remarkable other career as founding member of the Beaux-Arts Trio.
Thank you, Peter. I just don't want to finish this conversation without saying that you have been a very important and beautiful part of my life as a teacher and as a performer at IU.
Oh, thank you so much. And for Profiles, this is Peter Jacoby. Hello, this is Peter Jacoby for Profiles. With us for a second hour on the program is a man I call the little giant, a dynamo, Menachem Pressler. We devoted the earlier session to Professor Pressler's career as piano soloist and as teacher. He is renowned also, of course, as the founding member of that unmatched Beaux-Arts trio, the member who remains as a player 50 years after the ensemble's founding. When the trio was born, Menahem Pressler was its most junior member. Now, of course, he is its patriarch, and as such, he is a wonder to audiences, to critics, and undoubtedly to his colleagues in the trio. The ensemble has apparently meant the world to Menahem Pressler, too. A couple of years ago, he told me, it has been a way to try something beautiful, to experiment, to engage in wonderful repertory. The more deeply I've become involved for now close to 50 years, the more it has become my brain and love child. It allowed me to explore music of great wonder. It taught me dependency on two others who must share the music with me. And what luck I've had finding the right people for the collaboration. So now Menahem, the Beaux-Arts, is 50. What are your thoughts?
My heavens, I didn't realize I expressed myself so well at that point. Yes, I would say I'm lucky. I'm just a lucky duck. I have found two wonderful people now that the trio is set. Old, or that the pianist is that old in the trio, and have a trio now that I can explore even deeper and with the same passion and the same desire and the same commitment as I expressed at the point when I spoke to you about the trio. The trio itself seemed to have been a life of its own. I mean, we started it just as a thought from myself when I made these recordings for MGM, the solo records, and go to the director of recordings and said, I like to do some Mozart trios. And he said, go ahead. And for me to find the person in New York, not having gone to school in America, being just a young soloist living in New York, was a matter of, in this case, of great luck, because in the hotel apartment where we were living was the first of the second violinist of the NBC, the Orchestra of Toscanini. And he said, when I spoke to him, he said, why don't you ask Gillet, and our first cellist? And to make a long story short, it ended up by Gillet and Bernie Greenhouse, the cellist. Couldn't have been more fortunate and more wonderful for me, because Gillet, the most consummate chamber music player and musician, not always easy. I spoke about blood, sweat, and tears. He injected all that in each rehearsal. But in each rehearsal, it was really miraculous how I found myself being a member of the group, not just playing each one his instrument and his part well, not just that we play well together, not just that the balances between the three instruments were kept well, but that in front of my eyes a group was born that had a face, that had eyes, that had a heart, that breath together, that had, and all of a sudden it was a child called Beaux-Arts, and we could play in it. We each had a place in it so that it would be something that is complete. I must say that even today, after 50 years, I'm very grateful to this first time, because as a learning experience, it was very, very, very special. It's true, you go through life, and the ups and downs and the sideways and the whatever you have. But what remains in itself, how shall I say, so complete in its pleasure, is that having been a part of something that meant more than the input of each of us, that out came this child, Beaux-Arts, and very often inadvertent, I will listen to some of the old tapes or recordings that have been done, and I can't say I'm pleased, but I'm astonished that I thought, my, did I already at that time know what I know now? Sometimes it seems to me these things I thought I had just discovered, but we somehow were able to do it at that time. Like the very first time when we played the Ravel trio and we recorded it. It was pretty special to have done it. But I know that with a man like Gillet, who had, at the time when he came into my life, had played in front of Ravel, before Ravel. And so the tradition of playing it had gone from one to the other. And now it's going from me to my young friends.
Now, your debut as a trio came where?
The debut came on the 13th of July, 1955, in Tanglewood. And that is the interesting part, why it still exists, because we thought that after we played and we did our Mozart recording, we had 9 concerts, that the trio would disband and each one would continue his life as he was doing before. But after the concert in Tanglewood, which was attended to by Robert Casadesus, among others, Zeno Francescatti, the great violinist, we all of a sudden were offered, instead of the 9 concerts, 70 concerts. They were in small towns, but that was just at that time the right thing, because playing meant going from day to day and rehearsing and rehearsing and rehearsing and refining and creating and being together by simply trying to eradicate that which one does when you play for yourself, but that you become a member of a group, of a so-called team, that you play unified, that the conception was unified, that the feelings and the ability of receiving and giving to the other colleagues. Because on a given night, the inspiration of the one is bigger than the inspiration of the other. That is the one who leads that night. And to be able to accept that and to be able to refer to it and to be able to react to it is something that you have to learn. And so that was a wonderful and strong learning experience.
Well, this matter of becoming a unit, I mean, those of us who listen as consumers can gain great pleasure from experiencing a top-notch ensemble such as the Beaux-Arts. But as outsiders, we can't really know what it's like to come up with the idea even of collaborating with others over time, of blending one's artistry with others so that 3 musicians become one, of developing an at-one-ment. Do you recall anything from those early days about becoming a unit?
I do recall it very, very distinctly, because what it always was, that we always had a post-mortem. And in the post-mortem, that which was mostly discussed was not a place where we didn't play together exactly. We all heard that, and we would work it as first, because it's like musical hygiene. But what was the important part was when we created a balance that was the piece. That didn't mean that the piano plays so softly that it would be the accompanist to 2 strings, or that the piano played in such a way that the 2 strings were a poor man's orchestra. No, that it became something like a string quartet, a unit. Now, it's very, very difficult with a piano. And not everybody is trying to do just going through that process. I happened to fall into the hands of Gillet, who was a wonderful musician in that regard, and the beauty of the cellist like Bernard Greenhouse, who was very, very beautiful and inspired, and his sound was which created in me a desire to imitate that sound on the keyboard. That's not easy. Neither do I have a vibrato, nor can I do a slide. But I can imagine that and can try to just do as well or as beautiful as he did, and so fit into the conception. that doing it again and again and not being happy with what you have been doing, but that we knew that there is a sky above, that there is a upwards going. This wasn't just the playing the notes well. It wasn't just playing them with ease, but it was just, as I said, to become one. And they're very truly, when you know about it, how it is, there are truly very few ensembles that have done that and have been able to do that. And, that was what Beaux-Arts Trio at that time did.
Well, I thought it might be instructive to hear that first configuration of the Beaux-Arts, and you selected the first movement of the Ghost Trio of Beethoven's. Can you talk a bit about that choice?
Yes. You know, for the first time that we did the Beethoven cycle, which in the meantime I've done so very many times and will actually do it for the 50th anniversary nearly all over the world. But that was in Bloomington at East Hall. We were together and we were learning it. And what was so exciting was to play these works, learning them for the first time and having to perform them. Now, the Ghost Trio, for some reason or another, were at that time especially close to my heart, and I would say to our hearts. And that's why I would like to have that, this explosive first movement of the trio, where Beethoven is so ever expanding in energy that one feels one person is not enough to contain all this. No, in that case, he has three persons. And it's a great, wonderful movement, although the second movement has no equal either. But since we have limits in time, it's the first movement.
All right, here are Gillet, Greenhouse, and Pressler in the first movement of the Ghost Trio of Beethoven. Just heard the opening movement of the Beethoven Ghost Trio as performed by that original configuration of the Beaux-Arts Trio, Gillet, Greenhouse, and Menahem Pressler, who is our guest in the studio today. Menahem, those must have been heady days as you exploded upon the music scene like an unexpected champion or star. I mean, people won over audiences, surprising virtually everyone with your very presence. This was not a time when there were a lot of piano trios.
It's true. I mean, piano trios at that time were the million-dollar trio, which was Heifetz, Piatigorsky, and Rubinstein, and the example was Cortot, Thibaut, Casals. There was always these three wonderful, great musicians, each playing his instrument absolutely sublimely well and playing the music, which is sublimely beautiful. They did not need to, and they weren't really a one conception. Each one played according to his drummer, and they did meet at the right moment on the beat. But that which made it special in our case was just that. And when you said that we burst up on the scene, it's true, because we made a recording for a for a little record club, because no big company at the time would take the Beaux-Arts Trio. And we won the Grand Prix de Disque in France. So we did get a contract with Philips. And then, I mean, by this time, we had over 60 CDs and won most of the prizes that you can win as a trio for in that respect. We have done many, many things, and one always followed the other. And I can say, which is very, very nice to be able to say, that there are many towns in this world where when the trio now plays, it will be its 47th concerts in that town, its 45th concerts, its 49th concert, which meant nearly throughout the whole life of the trio, these people have always wanted the trio back. And I have always remembered there was one write-up in Montreal when they said, it's strange. There are many pianists and violinists and cellists who play the instrument as well as these guys. There are many people who play as well together as these three. But what is it that when the three play, that there is something that no other group is doing? And I can only figure it must be that which comes under the heading of inspiration. It's true that for the three of us who came through different schools, each one had in his thought, in his ideal, that which created the inspiration within each of us. I mean, Gillet, for him, Enesco was the great moment. He took lessons with him. Bernie, who went to Casals. And I, even listening to Schnabel, felt this enormous inspiration that exuded from his playing, and that we were trying to find a way of bringing it together. And whatever it was that happened, it is something like when you speak about love between people. It's chemistry. And that chemistry, if it's right, it happens. And it was right, and it did happen. And what is so beautiful is that the chemistry seemed to have stayed with us to this very day. Even though one reviewer even wrote about my trio now, saying he could be the father of the one and the grandfather of the other. When we meet in music and on musical terms, we are at equal age, we are at equal ability, we are at equal love.
Well, let's speak to this, because as the years passed, the trio's membership began to change.
Yes.
What pressures did that put upon you, first as one of two remaining founders, then as the one of one?
No, as the two remaining founders, that pressure was 50-50. It was easier because the two of us, the trio had its face, and so the new member would, to begin with, adjust to that and be part of it. And then the change would come gradually, and it would be, again, a trio. When I was alone to bring this to, then that is a different thing. Here, one had to do not, to begin with, the two that came in, especially my two now, which are exceedingly wonderful, they knew what Beaux-Arts Trio was. They had all their life listened to trios when they listened to a trio. It was the Beaux-Arts Trio. I mean, mostly. And so when they came into the trio, their desire to be a group that plays trios the way Beaux-Arts was used to, the way I was used to, was so great that in me the pleasure of playing and the desire of continuing to play remained very, very strong. When I did have a wonderful violinist in Yang-Woo Kim, wonderful man, wonderful violinist and good friend, when he couldn't play anymore and we had to change to a new violinist, I thought this would be it, because once more to go through the hardship and difficulty in creating a new trio would not be so easy. But as luck wanted it, I found, through circumstances, young Mr. Hope. And he made it possible for me to have the energy to have rehearsals of 5 hours of recreating and wanting to continue with the Bozart Trio. And now that I have it, I want very much to continue and hope that God will give me the time and the strength to do so.
There must be a stamp of individuality that marks the playing of a chamber ensemble. Can you describe yours and how you've maintained it through time and changes?
That's very difficult, because what it does is what you hear, Peter. Mm-hmm. If I would ask you, describe the Mozart for me. After all, you have heard it in different forms. You have heard it with different people. The one thing you know, it is in a trio, the pianist is primus inter pares. He is the first among equals. And in a trio, the score written really favoring the piano. I mean, the most important parts are within the pianist's realm. And when you have a heartbeat that continues, like in the Mozart trio, remaining the same, and in that sense, you have already one part of the warranty for a trio that will be playing well. Now, in this case here, I can see that at many times during the career of 50 years, there were many high points in which you experienced something very special. And that is what you are looking for when you have the trio again. You're looking for those high points. You're trying to recreate those high points. And I really can say, listening sometimes to a tape of a performance, we seem to be able to do it. And that, I cannot tell you what joy that is for me, and I'm sure what joy that is for each of them.
You know that it's happening while you're playing?
Oh, indeed. Oh, indeed. You, all of a sudden, the music becomes self-understood. You re-read that score that you are so familiar with. And it is familiar at the same time as it is new and as it is renewed for you. You feel the same freshness, the same love, the same passion that you felt the first time you played it. And this time you feel that the experience only enhances the passion. And yes, you do feel it at that moment.
Let's go back to music. We have a recording that dates to your 30th anniversary as an ensemble. And at that time, your membership was Isidore Cohen, Bernie Greenhouse, and you. And you selected from that recording the Schubert E-flat trio, the slow movement.
Yeah, I selected the slow movement because it gives this beautiful entrance played by Bernie Greenhouse. I haven't heard it again, but I am sure it is as enchanting as it was to me at that time. And I hope it will be enchanting to the people who hear it.
All right,
it's also a great moment in music. It's the moment that, you know, Schubert was dying. And he writes this slow movement that is so strong and so touching. I'm glad that I selected it.
It is pure rapture. We have just heard the slow movement of the Schubert E-flat trio with Isidore Cohen, Bernard Greenhouse, and Menachem Pressler. This was a 30th anniversary time for the trio. And you had a new violinist at that time. He'd been with you for a while, but talk a little bit about Mr. Cohen.
Now, Mr. Cohen is a wonderful chamber music player. When he came into the trio at that time, he had just resigned from the Juilliard Quartet, where he was second violinist, and a wonderful second violinist he was, and has a very strong love for music and for chamber music particularly. Had a lovely sound and had the right attitude. So he did fit beautifully within the trio, and we spent many, many years together and did many, many things together. So to have the 30th anniversary, that have been already, at that point, Cohen was 15 years with the trio, or 16 years with the trio. So he was really a very integral part of the rise of the trio to its, at that time, to its fame, if I may call that.
Yes, you may. Indeed. Now, each member of the Beaux-Arts, throughout its history, has held other jobs. I mean, you've taught, you've concertized, what have you. How have you juggled three careers for all those concerts scheduled every year?
It's hard to answer it, but in one word is simply, I would say, the luck of the draw had given me those genes which needed very little time in recuperating. Therefore, I found the energy to do it, and it fed on itself. I could never get enough. My friends were always saying, "Non, now you have done everything. Why don't you stop playing weddings and funerals?" So I stopped playing weddings, but I still am available for funerals.
Well, is the ensemble schedule as busy as in the past? I mean, how many concerts do you engage for each year?
No, it is not as busy as it was in the past. By far not as busy. Although this very year, it is quite busy. It's playing about 80 concerts all over the world. It's just traveling in itself is something. But it is busy because it's the 50th anniversary, and so many societies to whom we were close all over the world would like to present the trio. And I would like them to present the trio, and I'm proud to present the trio for its 50th anniversary, where we are going to do a new record, I would say an Olympic endurance record, playing at Ravinia all the Beethoven trios in two concerts. It's a three-concert series, but we are doing it in two concerts. And we are playing one day apart from the 13th of July. We play on the 14th of July in Tanglewood, the Beethoven, same Beethoven program with which the trio started. And I'm very, very, very proud that at my university, at my School of Music, I say mine because I feel such an integral part of that School of Music in Bloomington, that the trio is going to play this year three concerts. I'm very, very happy to have my 50th anniversary in Bloomington.
As are we, who will be able to hear them. It must be so gratifying to be invited back again, 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 and again. As you say, you have been in so many communities that people want you to return.
Yes, no, it is gratifying and it is challenging. You know that they ask you back because they loved what you have been doing. And you know that that must have been the best out of you. And so you always aim to be at those places where you played your best, to be at your best. And that is in itself a big battle, because it is not always on that and that day that you feel so good or feel so well. But it is the music that at that point, and it's also the way the audience listens. We have found that in listening, this audience has inspired us to play at our best. And we come into this place and there's these expectant faces in there. And all of a sudden, you feel yourself transformed and you're doing, in quotation mark, your best.
Do you remember any unusual happenings? I'm sure you must, in the history of the trio.
Oh, my God. Anything that could happen did happen. I mean, the things that did happen sometimes and that you have to go through with the pianos or with the page turner or with the chairs on which you sit or the dressing rooms or the arrival in time or not in time. Or everything has happened. And it's wonderful to be able to laugh afterwards. I remember once coming to Illinois, the University of Illinois, Champaign-Urbana, where we were spending the time with friends the whole day and go at 7 o'clock onto the stage to try out the stage. And there were three chairs, three music stands, no piano. Mm-hmm. And I said, "Where's the piano?" They said, "But your management said this is a string trio." Our management thought there were two strings and one piano. Of course, the majority are strings, so you call it string trio. No, I said, "We are a piano trio." Oh, they said, "It's 7 o'clock. My God, the piano is in the pit down there." No, I said, "Let's bring it up." He said, "There's nobody to bring it up." Then he looked at me and says, "Can you play in the pit and the two of them on stage?" No, I said, "No." Then he said, "No, how about the three of you playing in the pit?" He said, "We can't do that either." So I said, "Why don't we come back?" At that time, we were not that busy. "No, no, no," he said, "I have 1,200 people tonight." Anyway, he is asking the students to went on stage and said, "I need volunteers to bring up the piano." And there they were, taking the piano, and one, and two, and three, and there it was above the stage. And he says, "That's fine, now let's put it down." And they let go, and the piano came, bam, came down, and the pedals came off. And there was no piano tuner around, nothing. So I played my concert without the pedals. And as I am saying, and I know it was true, I had paid for all my sins. I had done, I was going to do, and I will do on my pedaling. So I am safe as far as that is concerned. No.
What about recordings? I mean, these are a very important part of your legacy. Preparing for them has to be consuming as well.
Of course. Of course, recording in itself is a difficult process, a very difficult process. And some of these where we really, you invest your time, your thoughts, your abilities, your pleasure, your passion, your love, your desire, your ambition. When we recorded Ravel, for instance, we recorded it 3 times. And always more and more it took on that which we felt was the right thing. And it actually ended up to be the right thing. Even in France, it did get the prize of the best record of the year in chamber music. And it was a French repertoire, and that made us especially proud. The other thing was Haydn. We discovered Haydn. Everybody played one or two Haydn trios, and we did play all 43. And with that, we created something very special. But in itself, to learn it, to build it, to create each one of them, was a process that took 8 years for us to record.
43 trios?
Yes.
Oh, my goodness.
But we have recorded Schubert or the trios twice. We've done the Beethoven trios twice. We've done Schumann trios twice. We have done so many, the Dvorak trios twice. Many, many wonderful experiences in doing it. And the interesting part for me, of course, is the redoing it, which is in itself a process of growth. And right now, my young trio, I call it my young trio because of my members now, we have re-recorded the very first one, the one that I told you won the Grand Prix, the disc, when the trios just started, which was a recording of Mendelssohn and Dvorak, which we have now done for a different company.
But let's turn to Ravel. You said that you've done that one three times, and you've done it most recently with your current members.
Yes, that is truly a piece that is very, very close to my heart and to their hearts. And it has such unique, beautiful moments in music that after all these years, 50 years, and I don't know, 200 performances of the piece, it still runs down cold my back when I start to play the piece and hear them, the strings take over the same theme. It is uniquely beautiful. It is always untouchable. And it is always something so special that you feel in a different sphere when you play it. I'm glad that you have it.
Well, we're going to hear the first movement of the Ravel. We have just heard the first movement of Ravel's trio, and it's with the current membership of the Beaux-Arts trio. Manon, talk to us a little bit about these two younger musicians whom you were sharing the stage with these days. Manon,
let me start with the older one first, which is Antonio Meneses, a wonderful and I would say a great cellist. He has all the possibilities. He's won when he was 26 the so-called Tchaikovsky competition in Moscow. He had won before the one in Germany, and he has played the cello and recorded many, many concerti, and is now probably one of the most expert cellists and most beautiful cellists that I have heard lately. He's also a wonderful member because he does want to play chamber music, not in order to play another date, but really to become a member of the trio, which has endeared him to me, of course. And Daniel Hope is really very, very special because in him all the ideas that are very original seem to be part of him. He is the boy who has this year been nominated for 2 Grammys. He didn't get it, but to just be nominated means to have out of hundreds or thousands of records is being 4 that are chosen to be nominated. And he has one record in which he plays the Berg and the Britten concerti, so as a concerto. And the other with the record that called East Meets West, and I must say that he plays a piece of Indian music by Ravi Shankar, which was written for Minuchin, the man who was helped him a great deal by sponsoring him and being a mentor to him. And then East Meets West, and playing the Ravel Tzigan and the Schnittke Sonata number 3. So he's a very imaginative and adventurous and beautiful violinist, completely devoted to playing a part in a trio. And I just adore the two boys. I call them boys. I adore playing with them, and it has given me such enormous amount of freedom of being able to do the things I always wanted to do, that I'm very grateful to have at that point in my life these two people.
Well, you spoke with me once about searching, that searching is what you do as a member of the Beaux-Arts. And I gather these two gentlemen are searchers along with you.
Absolutely. Absolutely. They are so happy when we discover something that seems, oh, why one passes by this moment. And then all of a sudden you see that this was rather a special moment. And the beautiful part being able to be alive and doing it up to this point is that you can re-examine again and find these special moments. I don't think that one lifetime is enough to do it all, but at least one can try.
Well, as you look forward, what do you see for the trio?
If I am blessed, which I feel I am right now, to continue that which we have been doing, and we will be playing now works of composers that were specially written for us. One is Kurtak, one of today's most important composers. One is Turnage, Britain's most important, also not most important, but one of the important composers of Britain. And Müller Wieland, a very fine German composer. They were new works. We are playing many new works. So what is in store for us is just go and discover this land or this heaven, which is called music.
What do you do when you're not engaged with music?
I will say that I do read, but I truly will say I am engaged continuously with music. I cannot see my life without music. It's a terrible thing. I mean, one could say, oh, why not gardening? Why not sport? And why not go and relax and sit on a seashore or go to the theater? I'm consumed with it, and I know it's a shortcoming in some respects. But that's me, and that is my way, and that's my life, and that's my pleasure, and that when I am not with music, I think about it.
Well, before we close, could you comment on your latest honor? I mean, you've become a commander in France's Order of Arts and Letters. So many honors, so many awards have come to you. Do they still have meaning at this stage in your life?
Of course they have meaning. They always have meaning. Only you see them in perspective. But they do have meaning, and they are gratefully accepted. And especially something that is with the word of commander. Now I can always ask my trio to salute me and say good morning when we start a rehearsal. But I am thrilled by it, absolutely thrilled by it, because it does not only honor me, but it honors everything around me, and I hope it honors my school.
Well, you're a gentleman who grabs hold of life, every moment of it, and it's wonderful to have spent another hour with you, Menahem Pressler. I thank you.
I thank you, Peter.
And I thank you out there for listening. This is Peter Jacoby for Profiles.
The program you just heard was recorded in the studios of WFIU in June of 2005. Christina Kuzmich, executive producer. The recording engineer and technical producer was Michael Paskash. Emily Blacklin, research assistant. Copies of this or other programs can be obtained by calling 812-855-1357. In addition, this and other Profiles programs can be accessed through our website at wfiu.indiana.edu. For WFIU, thanks for listening.